the helium in order to get oxygen in there in order for it to burn. And so if it's a big enough container and a 50-50 mix, it might be 10 times safer than pure hydrogen, if you know what I mean. And you're getting an intermediate. And by the way, if hydrogen has half the atomic weight, H2 has half the atomic weight of helium, shouldn't there be a close to a 2-to-1 ratio in the amount of your lift you get out of a balloon of helium versus hydrogen? Over to you, Roy. And I'm ignoring the weight of the balloon. Go ahead.
I'm going to have to look that one up because that I don't know. That's an interesting factoid that I have to double check. But as far as I'm aware, it's half the density, half twice the buoyancy, and I don't know where 7% comes in. But I look all these things up whenever anyone mentions things that they haven't come across my field of view.
Explain it. First of all, Bill wants to make a comment, and then somebody else. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, this is AC2IS, and I personally believe the dangers of hydrogen are kind of overstated. I mean, if it's, you know, amateurs working with it, then yes, okay, hydrogen is very dangerous to work with. But after you've gotten past your, you know, first one or two catastrophes, I would think that people would learn how to handle hydrogen properly. If you took hydrogen by itself and it was an atmosphere of pure hydrogen, you tried to light a match in there, it would not light. It would, or it would self-extinguish. Hydrogen by itself does not burn. You need oxygen as well. If you mix oxygen in, you've got brown gas, which is ridiculously dangerous. But if you have pure hydrogen, it's not so bad. The reason why the Hindenburg was such a problem was, I believe, not so much that it contained hydrogen, so much hydrogen, but that the skin of the aircraft had magnesium in it. Essentially, they built the skin of the Hindenburg out of flash paper. So you put those things together, and that's a really volatile combination. Let me break for a moment.
And shout into that microphone, Bill. Your audio is a little bit low.
Put something else in the mix to make your hydrogen less of a fire hazard. If you had access to helium, you would just use helium. The reason that the Hindenburg used hydrogen was that helium was simply not available to them. You could maintain... I believe, again, in the Hindenburg, there were individual sort of sacks of hydrogen, and it was not just sort of free throughout the interior. If you wanted to make that safer, I think you would fill the area in between probably with CO2, AC2IS.
Dick, I believe someone else wanted to make a comment, too.
Yeah, CO2 is a hell of a lot heavier than hydrogen or helium, so an awful lot of your lift would be gone. Who's the other person who wanted to make a comment?
Yeah, Dick, it was K1MJM, mic number 2. I was wondering if you wanted to know why the difference in buoyancy is only 7%.
We sure do. Go right ahead, Mike.
Okay, being a binary element, hydrogen is 2, molecular mass is 2, or I'm sorry, atomic mass is 2, helium is 4, the difference is 2, and you're floating it in air, which has an atomic mass of approximately 28, so it's the difference between the atomic mass of those two elements with respect to air. So if you look at that difference, it comes out to be about 7%. I do ballooning, and everybody just kind of assumes that hydrogen is going to give you twice as much lift, but it's not the case because it's all with respect to air.
Okay, Okay, that makes great sense. Thank you very much.
I got a problem here, Mike. 4 atomic units for the helium versus 28 for the air. That's a ratio of 7 to 1. 2 atomic units versus air for hydrogen. That's a ratio of 14. If I compare 7 to 14, I get a 2 to 1 ratio of lift of helium, a lift of hydrogen versus lift of helium. Where did my math go wrong on my head?
If you actually calculate the lift with respect to air, the difference is only 2. So it's 2 divided by 28, and that's the difference.
Helium is 7 times lighter than air. Hydrogen is 14 times lighter than air. Assuming I don't have any weight of my balloon itself, it seems to me like I should be getting a 2 to 1 difference in lift. Is there a well-documented source that you know of, Mike, that will tell us it's only a 7% improvement, in which case the Hindenburg wasn't getting as much advantage as we thought? How back to you, Mike.
Yeah, I think you're taking the approach wrong. You want to take a volume of helium and compare that to, or not compare that, calculate your lift, your buoyancy in air, and then take that same volume of hydrogen and calculate your buoyancy in air, and it's going to be 7. It's like I said, it's going to be 7%. 2 over 28. Or 28 and a half, whatever it is, and that's your difference in buoyancy.
Okay, I don't see the math that way, but I'm going to have to think about it some more. I think you might also get an eye-opening experience here, Roy, if you described what a helium atom would look like if we were able to take a photograph of it. If you go to Google and hit the word helium, and then go to Wikipedia, and halfway down the column in Wikipedia, they show you a picture of a helium atom. And my goodness, there is a factor in there that's really a mind blower. Over to you, Roy. I'll go back to that one if you want me to.
Okay, I'm not sure exactly what image you're referring to. I probably saw it, but it kind of goes back to the problem that we've had before, that I really hate the concept of the Bohr atom model, because it's very easy to understand the concept from a Bohr atom, but it has no relationship to reality. So if you're thinking of an electron circling a nucleus the way that a planet circles the sun, it doesn't really work like that, but the Bohr atom kind of would lead you an impression of that. So describe to me exactly what you're seeing in that diagram, and I'll get a better idea.
Yeah, the diagram tries to show you what a Bohr atom, or what a helium atom would look like if you could photograph it. The 2 electrons going around the nucleus are represented as a cloud, not a simple Bohr atom orbit like you've got with the planet going around the sun. It's a cloud. The cloud has an approximate outer diameter of 0.1 nanometer, 100 picometers. So 0.1 nanometer is the outer diameter. What's the magic about a helium atom and many other atoms is that the ratio of the diameter of the nucleus versus the outer diameter of that cloud is 100,000 to 1 ratio. The nucleus is 100,000 times smaller in diameter, so that if you made a full-scale model of a helium atom and you made that cloud as big as Wembley Stadium in London, Wembley Stadium has a circumference of 1 kilometer. So you got something as big as Wembley Stadium. That's the outer dimensions of the cloud of electrons. The nucleus would be a 1 millimeter BB in the center of the stadium. 1 millimeter BB in something as big as Wembley Stadium, and that's the nucleus of helium. Let me drop. Which shows you the degree of difficulty you'd have. If I've got a small balloon full of helium, it can't be a balloon, but if you know what I mean. I've got a container of helium, and I'm trying to bombard it with electrons, protons, whatever, from my particle accelerator. I want to see what happens when a particle at high velocity hits a helium atom. Because that nucleus is so small, it's got a diameter 100,000 times smaller, 10 to the 5 difference, which means the area of the nucleus is 10 to the 10 smaller in area. That means 99.99999% of all your particles that you're accelerating would miss the nucleus, and you would see nothing happening. And I think they've had an awful lot of experiments like that with particle accelerators. The cross-sectional area of that nucleus is extremely small. AC2GS, K2RIW, go ahead, Roy.
You're quite right, Dick. Most of the universe is empty space. You can take that on the level of galactic clusters all the way down to a single... You don't even have to go to a helium atom. You can go to a hydrogen atom. And it's the same thing. It's this little dot of mass, of an incredible space, and the electron existing someplace in a shell a long, long way from the nucleus. And that's probably why particle accelerators have to throw so many particles together, because a lot of them miss by a long shot. You know, one of the beauties of matter-antimatter annihilation is they have opposing charges. They have electromagnetism to help them collide with each other. But if either they're not charged or they're the same charge, then lots of luck. You need to put a lot of force and a lot of chances in the equation.
So if I wanted to bombard helium atoms with particles that I've accelerated, I think about the only way I'd survive the experiment, get some kind of action out of it, is if I highly cryogenically cooled the helium. That will make it occupy a much smaller volume, and I simultaneously put it under very high pressure. So if I can pack those helium molecules in there 1,000 times more dense, because I've lowered the temperature and increased the pressure, maybe I didn't even get 10,000 to 1 ratio by doing that, I would drastically increase the rate at which I would get an impact, and I could study what's happening. That's a guess on my part. And helium is being used tremendously for cryogenics, like the machines that your profession uses an awful lot these days. Nuclear magnetic resonance, better known as MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, those machines are cooled with liquid helium. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
Yes, indeed. That's one of the principal scientific uses for helium. There are helium refrigerating devices. Wesley has one in his house that can bring down temperatures to single-digit Kelvin. And if you did liquefy helium, yes, you'd get something like a more than a 1,000-fold improvement. Quite drastic, because even solids have a problem. Most of solids, once again, are empty spaces. So you'd still have to throw a lot of chances before you hit one correctly. So, yeah, you get improvement if you increase the density, but I don't know if I'd call it drastic. It's still problematic. Like I said before, whether it's gas, the liquid, or solid, most things are mostly empty space.
Intuitively, we'd think that empty space is filled with air. It is not. In this case, that empty space between that electron cloud and that nucleus, I think that empty space is essentially a perfect vacuum. I think it's pretty close to a perfect vacuum. What do you think, Roy? Can you drive it?
Well, I mean, now we fall into semantics. What is a perfect vacuum? It's probably not a perfect vacuum, depending upon how you want to define perfect vacuum. It probably has quantum fields running right through it. It just doesn't have particles for the most part. There are big spaces where there are no electrons, neutrinos, neutrons, photons, what have you. But photons can whiz by every so often, and there are fields, all manner of fields according to quantum field theory that coexist even in those little pieces, even if they're not excited, these fields.
In your field where magnetic resonance imaging is used for some very good diagnostic work, has anyone ever stated what the approximate price is the helium that goes into that cryogenically cooled superconducting magnet that gives you a 1 or 3 Tesla magnetic field that runs your MRI? What's the approximate price for one charge of the liquid helium? And if you're going to turn the machine off for the next 6 months, I'd like to believe they go through some kind of a process of recapturing that helium as opposed to just venting it to the air. Over to you for any comments on that one, Roy. AC2GS, K2IW.
Well, it's times like this that I wish we had our radiologist that we talked to a couple of years ago when we were talking about PET scanners, because I don't really know that much about the maintenance of the machines. I'm sure that if you're retiring it or putting it away for long storage, you discharge the helium and send it back to a factory. And there are research facilities that actually have mechanisms to trap helium that gets vented into the rooms that they're doing experiments and be repurified and tanked. So big facilities will recycle their helium. I don't know if anyone recycles the helium from MRI machines. I'm sure, unfortunately, they don't recycle the day-to-day helium that gets vented along the way. But I'm sure that when they have to put it in mothballs, they do. But I don't know the price. I mean, I gave you the price for a party tank, which is about, I think it was $40. I'm sure that the same quantity industrially costs about $4 or $5. Because, you know, they get it as a side effect, thankfully, of natural gas. It's in the cavities of the earth from radioactive decay of thorium and uranium and such.
If I want to inflate a bunch of helium balloons for my daughter's birthday party, and I buy that $40 tank of helium, is there a guess as to roughly how many balloons I can fill? I presume you're not going to fill the balloon with helium. I think you're just going to put enough helium in there so that the balloon rises. So I can inflate roughly how many balloons with that $40 tank? Do they ever advertise that number, Roy? Go ahead.
I guess ultimately it depends upon the size of the balloons that you use, but in retrospect, the last time that I actually looked at that ad, it's not a heck of a lot. It's only 15 cubic feet, so figure out how many balloons take up 15 cubic feet. Maybe it's 15 good-sized balloons, I would guess.
I think a typical party balloon is a very small fraction of a cubic foot. And if you're doing it efficiently, I'm guessing you only put half helium and the other half air. So if a balloon was, let me pick a number, 1/4 of a cubic foot, and I'm only going to put an 1/8 of a cubic foot per balloon, I might be able to give lifting capability to quite a large number of balloons if I'm efficient enough. Over to you, Roy.
I guess if you want to go for efficiency, usually people kind of go into the other phase of just pure opulence, and they want it to kind of jump up into the ceiling and stay there for as long as possible. So the balloons I've seen easily have at least half a cubic foot of gas in them, but I guess theoretically, if all you wanted was just enough buoyancy for it to rise, you could stretch it. But the balloons I've seen, people don't usually stretch things.
VDH with a comment on buoyancy.
Right ahead, Bob.
One comment. This is WA2VDH. One comment on the buoyancy before. I think buoyancy is proportional to the amount of air that is displaced, and I think that's where that 7% between hydrogen and helium comes from, is that the same amount of moles of hydrogen and helium only displaces 7% more air or something like that, and therefore the difference in the buoyancy is that 7%. Go ahead.
Thank you, Jeff.
The problem is people are getting buoyancy mixed up with density. They're different things, unfortunately.
But aren't we going to get the same number of molecules of helium versus number of molecules of air in that balloon? And if the molecules of helium are 7 to 1 lighter than the air, my goodness, we should be getting a pretty big percentage of buoyancy, I think. The balloon is displacing some volume of 28.5 grams per mole of air. And you're displacing that same number of cubic meters of air with something that's only 4 grams per Avogadro's numbers, you know, 4 grams per Avogadro's number. Seems like we should be getting a bigger ratio than 7%. Do you see a potential problem here, Roy, or do you think the 7% could be the right number?
ACJS, comment.
One second, Bill, and then we'll have you comment. I think the problem is this is the 7% is not helium versus room air. It's helium versus hydrogen because it's not directly related to hydrogen and helium, but how hydrogen and helium are related to the density of room air. And the difference to room air of the two gases is 7%.
I'm beginning to see it. You got it, Bill.
Yeah, I think the real problem here is the weight of the balloon itself versus the amount of buoyancy you're getting from your helium. So you're probably getting a lot of buoyancy, you know, compared to air, but the air doesn't weigh a lot probably compared to the weight of the balloon. So even though you're a lot more buoyant than the air, the combination of your helium buoyancy and plus the fact that you're weighed down by the balloon means that you don't have that much buoyancy, really, unless you start going with maybe really, really large balloons. AC2IS.
You said the magic number, the magic piece of information at the end, Bill. Because as you make the balloon bigger and bigger, volume goes up by radius cubed, but area of the skin of the balloon goes up by radius squared. So with a big enough balloon, 97% of the mass of the balloon is the contents of the balloon, not the surface of the balloon itself, if the balloon is big enough. Over to you, Roy, KGRIW.
AC2GS. Well, again, I think we're confusing things. The 7% is just the differential of the helium versus the hydrogen as it relates to the density of air. And then there's just the general problem of containing the lighter-than-air gas adds to the problems of buoyancy balancing, that you have to find a skin that's light enough, and perhaps that was one of the many problems dirigible that they chose one that would burn like heck. So that's a secondary complication.
Assume I've got a canoe that's capable, if I push down on it when it's in the water, is capable of displacing 100 pounds of water. It's capable of displacing 100 pounds of water, but my canoe only weighs 50 pounds. Couldn't I hang a, couldn't I put a, another 50-pound weight inside that that canoe without sinking it? So the weight of the object and the weight of the air is displacing, or the fluid, the weight of the fluid is displacing. Tell me why that doesn't equal the buoyancy. The difference in the weight and the weight of the fluid is displacing. That's the usual definition of buoyancy. Up to you, Roy. K2IW.
Okay, yes. In the real world, yes. And I agree with you. If you're built kind of dirigible or balloon or anything, you definitely have to factor in the weight of the structure surrounding it. But I think that when mentioned the 7% differential, that was beyond, that was without considering the additional weight of the structure that contained it. That's all that I'm trying to say.
I'm beginning to see it. That dirigible, if it was filled with air, air is 1.2 kilograms per cubic meter. Ordinary air at room temperature at sea level. Air is a lot heavier than we think. And so, if the dirigible itself could be made with zero weight, you would get a huge amount of lift out of the helium. But that helium has got a very small mass compared to the air. I think it's a 14-to-1 ratio. And when I replace it with hydrogen, it's only a very small decrease in the mass of the stuff I put in. I'm still getting almost all of that exact same amount of lift. I'm beginning to slowly see it. It's a crazy situation. In the case of a canoe in the water, depending on how far you push it into the water, you're changing, you're rapidly changing the volume of the water you're displacing. Let me drop. And that's where that difference of displacement versus what we call buoyancy comes in real fast. In the case of the dirigible, it's a fixed volume object that you're putting in a very low mass gas, giving you a whole lot of potential lift, and the other gas you can put in is just a little bit lighter in total number of pounds compared to the air. I'm beginning to believe. You got it, Roy. K2IW.
Okay, very good. I mean, the rowboat changes the volume of displacement depending upon the added mass that you put in the boat, whereas the dirigible has a fixed volume that doesn't change. And the density of helium, for anyone keeping notes, is 0.164 kilograms per cubic meter, as opposed to, as you mentioned, 1.225 kilograms per cubic meter for room air.
So only a 7% improvement. Who brought that to our attention? That was a goodie.
Was Mike. Mike number two, as you call him.
Give that man a cigar.
We learn something new every day. I mean, that's a wonderful reason for having this. I learn stuff, you learn stuff, we all learn stuff. Anyway, getting back to the fact that helium has a density of as I said, 0.164 kilograms per cubic meter versus room air, that's 1.25 kilograms per cubic meter. What would happen, I asked the participants out there, what would happen if you breathed in a full breath of helium?
You get helium voice.
Very good. What would happen if you were instead to inhale a lungful of some charming gas that's denser, like sulfur hexafluoride? That has a density of 6.17 kilograms per cubic meter.
There is a YouTube video where somebody did that. I presume sulfur hexafluoride is not toxic, and as long as you don't use nothing but helium in your lung for a long period of time, it's not toxic. But your voice becomes very low with sulfur hexafluoride. And I think somebody else had a comment that I covered up. Who was that person?
Yes, you're quite right, Dick, and there are many YouTubes that demonstrate that, because if there's one thing that people like to do the most, it tends to be huffing helium and sounding that way, like a chipmunk. And the second favorite thing on YouTube is to inhale sulfur hexafluoride and get a very, very deep voice. Now, sulfur hexafluoride by itself is not inherently dangerous. Industrial supplies are contaminated with all kinds of toxic things, so you have to make sure that the source is purified. And of course, we all like to breathe oxygen, and we're not really that good at knowing when there's no oxygen in the stuff that we're breathing. So if you keep huffing and puffing on things like sulfur hexafluoride or helium, eventually you're going to have hypoxia and collapse unconscious. So please don't take this as a party exercise. Do it with deep caution. Now, another question is, what would happen if you mixed half and half? Half helium, half sulfur hexafluoride. What would happen to your voice, if anything?
I'm guessing there's a magic mixing ratio where your voice would sound the same. Is that possible, Roy?
Yes, if you consider the density of sulfur hexafluoride versus the density of helium, you get a mixture of content that reaches the density of room air, and then you sound perfectly normal. You'd still collapse because there's no oxygen in it, but it wouldn't give you any strange voice.
There's something else to worry about here. In the case of helium, which is lighter than air, it's going to try to go to the top of your lung, and when you exhale it, it comes out pretty fast. In the case of sulfur hexafluoride, which is heavier than air, it's going to want to sit at the bottom of your lung. In order for you to get rid of it, I think you'd have to intentionally try to exhale as hard as you can, otherwise you're going to have a significant amount of it remaining in your lung. I suspect under normal breathing, we only exhale roughly half of the volume of our lung. We don't deeply exhale under normal breathing. Bunch of guesses on my part. Over to you, Roy, K2LIW.
Yes, I could see your point. I think, though, there's a great deal of ear turbulence in the lung. And so, and it's not a passive diffusion method. It's an active muscular action of accessory muscles and diaphragm. So I haven't offhand recall any story of people that stopped doing the sulfur hexafluoride and lost consciousness afterwards. It's usually the amount of hexafluoride dissipates with each breath, and 5-10 minutes in room air, it's pretty much mostly gone. So I haven't really heard any cautionary tales about that. It's just the idiots that just keep on doing the same thing over and over again, and finally their brain says, where's the oxygen, and they go bye-bye.
Now, exhaling deeply is something that can become very uncomfortable. I had some diagnostic testing a couple of years ago in which they wanted to put me into one of these three-dimensional x-ray machines. Can't think of the name of it right now. And they wanted me to exhale as hard as I could and then hold it for the next 15 seconds while they took a picture. Because the room they kept very cold and I'm shivering, and I had been normally breathing very fast before that, and they wanted me to exhale as hard as I could and hold it for 15 seconds. Boy, my lungs were screaming at me. My body was saying, I was literally shaking because of what they were asking me to do, which I guarantee made the photograph a hell of a lot less, I bet it was blurring, if you know what I mean. I think they should have asked me to hold my breath after inhaling, not exhaling. I wonder if they were making an error. Are you familiar with that diagnostic testing procedure? This was a coronary test of some kind. Over to you, Roy, KQRAW.
Well, it's difficult to say exactly what they were trying to do. There's something called the Valsalva maneuver, in which if you take a very deep breath and hold it for a couple of seconds, your vagus nerve reacts badly, and you can pinpoint cardiac problems. So that might have been what they were looking for. There's a whole bunch of different studies where they have people taking deep breaths in and deep breaths out, you know, pulmonary function tests and such. But, yeah, I think as long as you don't have to keep it, blow out and hold, it's not quite terribly uncomfortable unless you're suffering from some underlying pulmonary disease in the first place. You know, people for the most part, other than people with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and physique, don't really have that much of a problem with taking deep breaths.
Yeah, but they weren't asking me to take a deep breath. They were asking me to exhale as hard as I could and hold it for 15 seconds. When you're in a cold room and you're shivering, that's an extremely difficult maneuver to do.
I agree, and it's not a physiologically normal one. People don't do that as normal behavior. It's a method to stress your body in a particular way when they're looking for a particular problem, and I think that's why they had you do it. But we're not really designed to do that much, and so, yeah, I agree that it's very uncomfortable and can be very difficult.
With all the questions you've been asking so far, Roy, you've been getting a lot of participation from a lot of people. So you've been tickling their interest. Please continue.
Okay, very well. As interesting as gaseous helium seems, it gets a lot more interesting when you get it down to its liquid phase. Helium has the lowest known boiling point, 4.2 degrees Kelvin at one atmosphere of pressure. It takes very little energy to get liquid helium to phase change into gaseous helium. That's called its heat of vaporization. Its heat of vaporization is 100 times smaller than that of water. So if you just look at it cross-eyed, liquid helium will evaporate on you. If you've ever seen liquid helium, you may have noticed something very curious. It appears to be almost transparent. That's because its refractive index is something like 1.03, which is very close to the refractive index of room air, so it's practically invisible. At normal atmospheric pressures, scientists have not been able to force helium into solid phase. You have to bring it up to a pressure of 25 atmospheres, bring the temperature down to 0.95 degrees Kelvin to get any solid helium at all. But some of the most interesting things go on when helium is a liquid, so let's focus on that one. At 2.17 degrees Kelvin at one atmosphere of pressure, helium turns into something called a superfluid. A superfluid is related to another presence from Albert Einstein's mind, the Bose-Einstein condensate. These are collections of atoms which seem to act in ways like enormous single atoms, with all the quantum spookiness that this might imply. Superfluid helium, which is sometimes called helium-2, has no viscosity. It has no friction. It has entropy. None at all. If you put it in many types of glass containers, it just leaks through the atom-sized holes that are common in solid glass, like a novelty store dribble glass. If you place it in a container...
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
Yeah, you timed out the last 30 seconds or so, boy, you might want to repeat that.
Okay. To me, though, the strangest characteristic of helium-2 is how it acts like a single atom with those non-intuitive characteristics that make quantum mechanics so difficult for us all. If you take most liquids and place them in a container and start to spin them, depending upon their viscosity, as you... faster, the liquid inside the container gradually speeds up as well. No matter how little you increase your spinning, any increase on your part will lead to your liquid sample increasing its own spinning vertices. And liquid helium above 2.17 degrees Kelvin would act just the same. Let me drop. But at 2.17 degrees Kelvin and below, you have a Bose-Einstein condensate. Like superfluid and quantum rules the roost. The superfluid has a minimum angular momentum. If you spin your container, your superfluid will just sit there and not spin at all. When you reach the critical angular momentum, your superfluid will manifest vortices with that critical angular momentum. Increase your container's spin to almost twice that angular velocity, and nothing changes. Superfluids will not produce vortices that are not multiples of its critical angle momentum. You don't need any fancy equipment to see those quantum mechanically determined vortices. They are visible to the human eye. Quantum mechanics spookiness at macroscopic scales. And just for that physics cherry on the top, there is the finding that helium-3 doesn't become a superfluid at the same temperature as helium-4. And it amounts to the same reason that helium-4 had paired up with neutrons and helium-3 does not. So it doesn't only just cause the magnetic moments, but it screws around with superfluidity. So that's just a small version of the story of helium-2 and helium-1.
Because helium has such a low heat of vaporization, in other words, when you go from the liquid state to the gaseous state, very little heat is required. Because putting liquid helium in a MRI machine keeps that magnet supercooled at a critical, at a cryogenic temperature, only if the helium is continuously boiling off. So that helium in your MRI machine is continuously boiling off in order to create the cooling, because some amount of heat is always flowing into the machine. The insulation is never perfect. That implies that your MRI machine has to be recharged with helium periodically. I wonder if they do that every 2 days or every week or whatever. And there must be a service that a hospital has to hire in order to do that recharging. Bunch of guesses on my part. Over to you, Roy, KTRIW.
Well, I don't know if it's that esoteric. Again, unfortunately, I never bothered to read maintenance of these machines, but I assume you just buy tanks with helium and charging and keep trading the tanks as people do with barbecues all the time. I don't think it's incredibly esoteric. It's not that it has to evaporate the helium to keep the temperature down, because I'm sure it uses compression and expansion of helium gas as the method, although it's not perfect and there'll be some helium lost. But I assume it's not that problematic.
Are you telling me that there is a helium-fed refrigerator unit in the machine, so therefore the helium doesn't have to be vented?
From US to N.
Go ahead, WS to N. Maybe he knows more about it.
Very little. I just spent a couple of days years ago when these MRIs first came out. First of all, they would come off the trucks and they would have have all these tanks hooked up to them, and they would be constantly venting the helium. But once they were installed in the room, they eventually would be hooked up to a cascade cryogenic system. So they have some kind of refrigerant system that keep it, you know, and then, you know, they have a cascade system. So you have one refrigerant is cooling another refrigerant, that type of thing. That was 25 years ago, more. So I don't know what they're doing nowadays, but that gives you an idea. When they were first installing them on Long Island, I got involved with two of those projects for short periods of time back to you there.
Back to you, Roy.
It's probably a function of what kind of superconductors they're using, of how much they have to temperature, of whether they have to use liquid helium or they can simply use helium refrigerant, you know, compressors and such.
Yeah, there are so-called high-temperature superconducting metals. So if the coil of that magnet is made out of the right stuff, maybe it only has to be kept below, let me pick a number, 60 degrees Kelvin in order to stay superconductive. Over to you, Roy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, at one point you're able to just kind of use a self-contained helium and not have to blow it off, whether it's 60 degrees Kelvin or 30 degrees Kelvin or something, but I'm sure there are different designs that work in different ways, and unfortunately, helium is not a easily replaceable commodity on this planet. It's sort of a shame, being that it makes up 24% of the entire universe by mass, of light mass, as opposed to dark matter or dark energy, whatever those things are. But if we keep using it the way we're using it, we're going to run out. You know, I mean, there's always thorium and uranium breaking down into alpha particles, and that's really helium, but at a slow rate. So we got to figure out what we're going to do about that.
I believe you said earlier, Roy, that the majority of the helium that we get it by mining. In other words, there's a pocket of helium above some of these underground facilities, and that's the inexpensive way of getting it as opposed to refining it from the air. But it does sound like the total amount of helium on planet Earth is slowly being vented into space. So it's going to become more and more difficult as time goes on to get the amount that we need for cryogenics. That's a guess. Over to you, Roy, KQIW.
KQIW, comment.
Yes, Bill, comment away.
And Bill, please shout into that mic. Your audio is a bit low.
All right. My understanding is that there used to be a law mandating that helium be collected during these mining operations, mainly for oil or natural gas, I think. And that this law is no longer in effect, so that the price of helium probably went up as a result. Because there used to be some mandated operations that are no longer mandated, and in some cases, this helium could just be directly vented into the atmosphere and not collected. Is that the case, AC2IS?
Yes, Bill, that's my understanding, that there used to be a law, or there isn't a law, and most of the helium that we get are in pockets of natural gas. It's the easiest way to get gas pockets from thorium and uranium ore in the earth to slowly leak into close to the surface, and when we get oil and, for the most part, natural gas, there's a great deal of residual helium that's relatively cheap to extract and purify. But the regulations are getting looser and looser as our supply gets smaller and smaller.
Thank you. you think we're going to run out of that stuff?
Now, you know, again, in semantics, you'll never really run out of it entirely because we live in on a planet that's basically a big rock of thorium and uranium that's slowly giving off alpha particles. So it'll kind of slowly collect. But the problem is it's not going to do it in any kind of a rate that's in any way industrial. So, and it's impossible. It's kind of like, when are we going to run out of oil? I mean, how do I know that next Wednesday they won't discover a new incredible pocket of natural gas and helium in some place in Asia that's twice as big as anything in Saudi Arabia or any place around there? You know, you never know. Until you run out of it, you never know how long it's going to last.
I remember reading somewhere that there was a concern that we're using it up faster than the Earth is generating it. So just a thought.
Where do you think we're storing helium now? We must be stockpiling it, Roy. And do we store all of it in one place? And are we rationing it if other countries want to buy some of it from us?
I don't know for sure. I mean, unfortunately, my guess is that it's not as well organized as we all would hope it to be. We have a massive quantity of it because we have a lot of natural gas, but there are other countries that have natural gas as well, and so they can develop their own helium storages. But I don't think the government is kind of thinking ahead for this.
Yeah, we certainly did ration helium to Germany during World War II, and that's the reason why they started using hydrogen, because they had no choice. I wonder if that's the only country we ever rationed it to. Now, helium-3, does it have very different properties from helium-4 when it comes to Bose-Einstein and superfluidity and whatever? How different is helium-3, and is it only different in mass, but because it's got the same number of electrons in the cloud, that chemically we don't see any difference? Over to you, Roy, KTRIW.
AC2IS, comment.
Yeah, Bill?
Wanted to comment on the storage facilities. I believe there is a strategic reserve of helium. I'm not 100% sure if that's something that was mandated, but I think it was. And then at some point there were issues. This storage facility, I believe, depends on cryogenics, and there was a power outage, I believe, or a storm resulting in a power outage that at one point caused a lot of helium to be released from the strategic reserve. So there was a huge loss of helium at one point. AC2IS.
Okay. As I always say, Google and Wikipedia is your friend. Apparently, there is a national helium reserve. By 1995, a billion cubic meters of the gas had been collected, and the reserve was $1.4 billion in debt, prompting Congress to begin phasing out the reserve in 1996. The resulting Helium Privatization Act of 1996 directed the government of the Interior, Department of the Interior, to start selling off the reserves by 2005. By 2007, the federal government was reported as auctioning off the helium plant. The National Helium Reserve itself was reported as slowly being drawn down and sold to private industry. However, by early 2011, the facility was still in government hands. In May 2013, the House of Representatives voted to extend the life of the reserve under government control.
So does that mean they sold off 50% of it and then decided to hold on to the rest? Is that roughly what's going on here, Roy?
Yes, this is our lovely government. Two steps forward, one step backward, one step to the right, two steps to the left. Eventually, they'll get somewhere, someplace, sometime.
In the case of the polonium that we use for nuclear power supplies in our spacecraft, I know there's a definite shortage of that kind of polonium, plutonium polonium, but is there a concern that you know of the amount of helium that we have versus the rate at which we're so-called consuming it or using it, so to speak? Are we worried about running out? Over to you, Roy.
In a word, yes. I mean, I'm concerned. I'm sure you're concerned. There's a lot of scientists who are deeply concerned. There's some politicians who are concerned, and unfortunately, there's a bunch of politicians who just want to know how much we can make off of it. But, yeah, because, again, it's not an easily obtainable product. I mean, I guess if you had some kind of magic rocket engine and can scoop up a lot of helium from a solar gas, then that would be peachy keen, but that ain't happening anytime soon. So, yeah, people are deeply concerned. We need this stuff.
Yeah, there may be an awful lot of helium still on the sun, but obtaining it is out of the question as I see it. And even if you dream that the solar wind contains a lot of helium, somehow I doubt it.
Well, the sun is about, as I said before, it's about 74% hydrogen and 25% helium. And so all gases blowing off there contain, you know, three parts hydrogen to one part helium, if you could scoop it up somehow. I mean, it strikes me as always incredible that the theory is that after the Big Bang, the universe was basically made out of 75% hydrogen and 25% helium. And it's been 4 billion years almost, and the stars have been burning, and yet it hasn't put a dent in the amount of hydrogen and helium from the time that the Big Bang began. So I find that fascinating. Let me drop for a sec.
Yeah, run that by again. The percentage of hydrogen and helium at the instant of Big Bang versus 13.7 billion years later, that ratio is almost the same. Over to you, Roy.
Yes, the guys who think that they know it all believe that the ratio of 24% helium and 75% hydrogen is almost identical to the amount that was created at the Big Bang. You know, the amount of nucleogenesis that's produced at the core of stars and supernovas is just a drop in the bucket, according to these guys.
All those stars putting out such tremendous amount of nuclear energy are burning hydrogen into helium, and yet the rate at which they're burning hydrogen is not changing the ratio of hydrogen to helium in the universe after 14 billion years. That's crazy.
Well, you have to consider that there's a lot more hydrogen and helium gas in the universe that isn't located in a burning star. That's just kind of either in a gas giant or in some other structure, or just kind of wafting between galaxies. Like I said before, there's a lot of empty space, and some of that empty space is filled up with little bits and pieces of hydrogen and helium gas. So although conversion is taking place actively on our sun and many of the stars that we see in the sky, all those places between all those lights in the sky are just kind of sitting there. And so I guess that's where all the hydrogen and helium is kind of hiding out.
It sounds like there's a significant amount of hydrogen and helium floating free between the galaxies, between the stars, which is another deterrent. If you and I had the ability to move our spacecraft at the speed of light and we're running into those gases, I think the leading edge of our spacecraft would run awful hot. Over to you.
Well, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, when you get to near relativistic speeds, all kinds of spooky things happen to kind of get in the way of things. But, yeah, one of the many things is that over the long haul of traveling in the universe, you're going to bump into more than a few molecules of gas. It's not a factor when you're traveling at reasonable speeds, but when you're coming close to relativistic speeds, anything in your path is a big obstacle. So, you know, you can put that down with about 3,000 other problems with relativistic traveling.